Charlie Bazina is back this week, and he has a lot to tell us about his time in the police force, from his role as a homicide investigator to his observations about how the force's methods have changed over the last four decades. Before we jump into that discussion, however, we have an extra piece of material to share with you.
This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Recently, Michelle visited two prisons in regional Victoria as part of an author speaking program and was inspired by some of the stories and writings the prisoners had to share. Here's Michelle and Emily with more.
Emily, I have to tell you just before we crack on with this episode about something really amazing that I stumbled into.
Now, I saw on Twitter this week that you had actually visited a men's prison, and I know that we've had a few people very interested about what you were doing there.
Two prisons, actually. They're in Castlemaine in Victoria. They're next door to each other. One's a minimum security, one's medium security. And a lady called Lisa D'Onofrio contacted me, and this lady is a saint. She has got such an interesting job, but of course, you know, I can't imagine how draining it must be sometimes. But let me tell you the story of how her job came about, because it's an incredible story about women with passion wanting to do something interesting and just, you know, generous with their lives. So there's a group of women called Friends of Castlemaine Library. They're volunteers. And they thought to themselves, we want to do something to do with the prisons out here. Castlemaine's a really small town in Victoria. I'd never been there before
the
other day.
It's quite trendy now, isn't it?
Oh,
I think
it's very
beautiful.
Sweet. It's ever so sweet. It's a very old town, so it's these beautiful little houses and little old buildings. It's very tiny. And so these ladies, and it's got this prison right there. And so the ladies thought, we want to engage the prisoners with the library. We want to work on literacy at the prison. So they came up with this idea, and they got funding to hire a person to send into the prison to do library stuff. Mm. The first thing they came up with was this idea of having the prisoners read a book on tape and then send the tape and the book to their children.
Oh, how wonderful.
Isn't that a beautiful idea?
Yeah.
So that they could effectively keep reading to their own children.
That's really lovely.
It's really lovely. And that was 6 years ago. And that the person they hired was Lisa. And then out of that, lots of other programs have developed. And she runs a creative writing course. They have English classes. They have lots of things. And part of it is she gets authors to come out and speak. And I was one of them. And I spoke in both campuses of the prison, and it was just amazing. I spoke to about 50 men in each case, and, you know, they were funny, great, you know, a little bit challenging, as you would expect any group of people to be, but I held my own, don't worry about that. But she gave me this book, and it's such a shame I'm not allowed to read it to you on the podcast. I'm not allowed to publish it online because Corrections Victoria haven't given me permission to do that. I'm going to try really hard to get permission. It's called Letters from the Inside. It's something that Lisa put together. It was a big project that they worked on where the men wrote letters to myself. Hello, 12-year-old me is one. Dear My Cell is another one. Someone wrote a letter to their cell, which is so great. It's all about it being my sanctuary, how close we are, my cell and I. It's really great. And it's also, I just always think, you know, perpetrators of crime and their families are, of course, shamed in our culture. And we talked a lot about shame, actually, in one of the sessions. We talked about how shame is a very useful mechanism. We all need it to tell us when we're doing something that we shouldn't be doing, but how also it can be a really damaging thing. And I just think we have so much to learn from perpetrators and from their families. And I loved the episode that you did when I was on holidays about people whose parents had been to jail. And
we've had a lot of feedback about that. And a number of people whose parent has been in jail and they found they were very isolated by that experience, and they found listening to someone was really good for them.
I'd love to hear from more people, more families who have been impacted, who have a family member who has perpetrated a crime, or perhaps you yourself have perpetrated a crime. Perhaps you've been to jail and are out of jail. If you are I'm not going to say happy to, you're brave enough, if you're prepared to talk about the experience, because I think we have a lot to learn from perpetrators of crime. Who better to learn from about how to prevent it from happening than people who have done it. What a great program it is. I met a man who writes 5-page letters to his daughters. They are teenagers. And I was like, no offense, but what do you write about? Because every day is the same for you. Like, what do you think about to write about? And he said, well, I write about them. Like, the letter's all about their lives. So I start by asking what's going on, and then I'm interested in their lives. And his eldest daughter is studying medicine. So
wow,
they're going okay.
Yep. Isn't it amazing what people involved with libraries do?
Yes.
And people are passionate about words and about doing good things for people. I love libraries. I love librarians. I love volunteers.
I met a man in that prison who's about 50 years old and can't read.
Yep.
And I just thought, well, where else would you end up but jail?
Yeah. How do you access the world when you can't read?
How do you make a living? How do you do anything?
Yeah.
And so just on that day that I was there, he signed up for the English class. He's going to try and learn how to read.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, yes, please, we would love to hear from you. Hit us up on Facebook, Australian True Crime, if you would like to talk to us about your experience as a perpetrator of crime or as the family member of a perpetrator of crime. I would love to hear from you. And now, on with the show.
And now, Charlie Bazina tells us about a particular case from his time at the Homicide Squad, which serves as an interesting window into the meticulous investigatory procedures and the high standards of evidence detectives are expected to provide when investigating a suspicious death.
So like all crimes, and murder in particular, we've got to let the crime scene tell us a story. The body then tells us a story, as along with witnesses and the other evidence we gather.
Mm-hmm.
We as investigators have to find the truth to the matter as best we can. A lot of times we're not going to get the evidence to support it categorically and say, well, I can tell you A because here's B. It's not always going to work that way. You're going to work a lot of times on your experience, your gut feeling and the likes. We're not going to make an accident or a suicide into a homicide. We've got to be very, very mindful of that. We get enough homicides to investigate. Well, we probably get 60 to 70, 80 a year. Well, not as 80, but probably a bit less than that. But so clearly we've got to go in, and we're taught as young detectives, the first thing you've got to find out, has a crime been committed? Mm. We've got a suspicious death. Homicide Squad investigate all suspicious deaths until the contrary is proved. Is it a suicide? Is it natural causes? Or is it a homicide? And that's our role, is to investigate that. This particular case, it was quite some number of years ago. It was middle of February, quite hot. The body of an elderly lady was found on the blind side of her house out in the eastern suburbs. The body, just to draw the picture, was on the blind side of the house. The body was on its back, significantly decomposed. The lady was wearing a skirt, no underwear, and the legs were splayed open. He says, start looking at the crime scene and tell, what's the crime scene tell us? We then start the investigation. So we know we got a blood trail up the driveway with one of her shoes. We've got the deceased female, and interestingly enough, she's lying on her back there with her legs splayed open, no underwear. You look at the possible situation that she might be sexually assaulted and then murdered.
Mm-hmm. Who called it in? Who discovered her body?
I think it was one of the neighbours,
okay,
that actually called it in from the actual smell,
mm-hmm,
from the decomposition. So the difficulty we then started having was, okay, we looked at the house. The house hadn't been burgled. We couldn't get in. We had to break our way in just to see, you know, was it a burglary gone wrong? And then the offenders put the body on the blind side of the house so it wouldn't be found by anybody. You throw that net quite open, but you don't start jumping to conclusions. Regardless of what comes along, you've got to look at that open mind. So without doing the post-mortem, so as an investigator, the first thing I want to know is cause of death.
Mm.
I don't want to be investigating a heart attack.
Yeah.
I'm going to walk away, regardless of what the crime scene looks like. So we couldn't get a cause of death because of the significant decomposition.
Mm.
And as hard as it is, and this plays a role, so you know the body was maggot-infested because of the decomposition.
Can I just ask, how many people come to the crime scene or the death scene?
Look, it's a matter of initially, and this is how the process works. Your divisional van is what we call the workhorse of the area.
Mm-hmm.
So your divisional van gets called. If someone rings up, look, there's a bad smell coming from this location, or there's a broken window, or this crime's happened. So the divisional van attends.
Mm-hmm.
They find the body. They then call the local detectives.
Mm-hmm.
So the local detectives come along. They make an assessment. Then they call the specialist unit. be it the rape squad, armed robbery, or the homicide squad. In this case, the homicide squad. So we go out initially, we call our crime scene examiners to come with us. Mm. So we've got a crime scene examiner that comes along with a photographer and a video operator and the likes. They're getting a bit multi-skilled now. So we've got to videotape all our crime scenes. We've got to photograph our crime scenes because we can never go back once we leave that crime scene.
Yeah. So is that you walking around verbalising what you're seeing for the video?
No. The video is silent.
Okay.
It takes that in.
Right.
I'm then taking my own notes as all of my investigators are.
Okay.
Then we'll be speaking quite significantly with the pathologist.
Okay, on the scene there.
Yeah. More often than not, we'll have a pathologist attend the scene with us because it's ideal for us for the pathologist to see the body in situ.
Yes.
Because rather than see the body on the trolley at the coroner's court and say, well, I wonder how that impression was on that arm or why is that mark on there, they can see the body actually as it's found.
Mm.
In the environment,
which
is significant for them. So more often than not, the pathologist comes out, they certify death and look at the scene themselves and say, okay, guys, we book in a post-mortem time and we'll get it done straight away.
Mm.
So the body will head back to the coroner's court in South Melbourne. We'll book in, let's say, for 3 or 4 hours later. We'll then process the crime scene. So the body's taken away. And in this particular case, once at the coroner's court, we will then go along and witness the post-mortem because we are the investigators.
Yeah.
We're in investigative mode and there's a process. A homicide and post-mortem will take 4 to 5 hours.
Wow.
On average. So because the body had been infested with these bugs, we called in an entomologist because one of the major issues, apart from cause of death, is time of death. And let's not lose sight of the fact what we see on TV is not what actually happens.
Yeah.
You often see on these cop shows in America or in England or wherever the case may be, the detective will say to the pathologist, when was the time of death? The time of death was between 12:30 and 2 o'clock. Well, that's a lot of hogwash.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot be that accurate. Time of death becomes on temperature of the body, which is so variable.
Mm-hmm.
Time of death is significant for us as investigators because it can knock out alibis. We really have to show when was the person last seen alive to when it was found deceased. And if we ever do get suspects, we can then start putting, well, where were you at this particular time, et cetera, et cetera. So it helps us significantly. So at the post-mortem, we called an entomologist to collect the infestation of the maggots and the likes.
So they collect those at the
coroner's? At the post-mortem, yeah.
At South Melbourne.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the body's not touched at that stage. We photograph the body overall. Mm-hmm. We then start getting other evidence we collect before we wash the body and then take the clothing, et cetera, et cetera. So we do that, and we do that in particular because we know that an entomologist can tell us a more accurate time of death by the laying of the eggs by the blowflies.
Mm.
Then they work the metamorphosis back with the maggot of, okay, that's at this stage, work it back, and I can say, look, we know the eggs were laid here, the maggots are at this particular stage of gestation. So realistically, the body's been there for 5 or 6 hours, which gives us a more accurate, apart from the body temperature.
Mm.
So we have that in place, which is going to help us. So we start doing the investigation. And so we're confronted with this body in bad decomposition on the side of the house, post-mortem. And the end of the post-mortem is there is no cause of death. Because of the significant decomposition with the internal organs, there is no causation. I can say definitively that this person's been strangled, hasn't been stabbed, hasn't been shot. There's no indication of that. But if it was strangled, I can't tell you that because of decomposition. What I can tell you as a pathologist is this particular victim has symmetrical fractures to her face.
Oh.
Which causes us concern. So that's a concern for us. So the end report from the pathologist is, I can't give you cause of death. I can't tell you where the body was sexually interfered with, given the way it was found.
Okay.
But I can tell you is, conclusively, this body has symmetrical fractures to the face. So, Charlie, it's either an assault, she's died as a result of the assault, or it's an accident.
Mm.
So they cannot be more definitive than that. Charlie, it's your role and your investigators to find out what the real true story is.
Mm.
So that was what we're confronted with. So we start doing our investigation. We've got blood trail, a small blood trail up the driveway with one of the deceased shoes. The wrought iron gate's open. She's lying there with a towel over her face. Now, that tells you something also, that as investigators, you know the position she's found in, and your experience tells you that, sure, she might have been raped. And if we do have these people in a community like that, that's raped this woman after they've killed her, mm-hmm. that they will put a towel over their face because they don't want to look at the face during the act. Mm-hmm. So we said, okay, that's a possibility. And the person's put the body on the side of the house to hide it from anybody. They've placed this towel over her face. They didn't want to see the body if they've done another offence on the deceased. Then you start doing an investigation. Well, the body, the house has not been forcibly entered. It hasn't been burgled. Okay, we can eliminate that. So you start looking at your crime in the area. Has there been burglaries going on? Have there been assaults on people or whatever the case may be? No, nothing.
So you'd have mad door knocking going on.
Absolutely. Door knocks are so valuable to us as investigators, apart from the forensic evidence and the likes. So whilst we're doing this, she was a well-known elderly lady, a little bit eccentric, in the area. And the story comes to us from the neighbours that, look, because I think she may have been reported to the police some time previous, that this lady would go out at night time with a shopping trolley and steal things from the front gardens of houses, pavers, gnomes, pot plants,
right.
which we found evidence of in her backyard.
Right.
And then, you know, you start building up the picture of the deceased. And that's what we always do with investigations. We want to know as much as we can about that deceased person, apart from causation, where she'd been last seen alive, et cetera, and building up this picture and going backwards in relation to this person. So we also found out through witnesses that there's been a number of times she's been found in persons' backyards on top of outbuildings.
In their backyards?
In their backyards, on top of outbuildings, you know.
On the shed?
Yeah, on the shed. Small sheds, you know.
Yeah, but still.
For whatever reason. As I said, she was...
Because that's different to me to pinching pot plants or gnomes from the front yard. To actually then venture into the backyard and beyond your shed.
Yeah. Depends on the accessibility. You know, some might be open and... Yeah. So, but... We start drawing that picture of this lady. She was a climber of sorts.
Yes.
So and then we start building up this picture that we know that on her wrought iron gate, and she was a harmless elderly lady. I said a little bit eccentric that she would tie her large wrought iron gates up with a terra-toweling towel similar to what was found on the body.
Ah.
Okay. So we know that she's a little bit eccentric. She's nocturnal. Does all this pilfering of things from front yards and the likes. She's a climber. And in examining the crime scene behind the wrought iron gates, we look at the fence. And it's unbelievable. The cross-section of the fence was worn out on the two sections, which was indicative of someone climbing.
Wow.
All the time. So that's behind the gate.
Yeah.
So behind the gate, so we start drawing up this picture. And that's where your experience comes in as investigators. You start saying, well, so we have no definitive evidence of it. We know that the type of person she is. So we drew this idea up to say, well, okay, she ties up her gate with a terra-toweling a face washer type thing.
Yeah.
She then would climb over the gate, and in doing so, we put it together, she's then fallen. The next door was a block of flats, so she's fallen face first onto the driveway of the block of flats.
Yeah.
Because that would account for the symmetrical fractures, because you need a big flat surface to give you symmetrical fractures on your face.
Oh.
Because had she been assaulted, you wouldn't get symmetrical fractures. You would get a fracture to the right side of the face, to the left side, or whatever the case may be.
So she's literally fallen flat on her
face.
That's
right. And that's the picture we start putting together on our pathology report. How does someone get symmetrical fractures, you know, there? Because... has someone come in with a fry pan and gone bang, some flat object?
Yeah.
It's unusual. That, to us, held water. We then start putting the pictures together that she then was either internally bleeding inside her face or in her mouth, and then she's walked along and hopped over her fence. That accounts for the blood droplets and losing a shoe.
Yeah.
So one of the other issues when you go to these crime scenes is you'd ask yourself, as I did all the time, why would someone want to kill this person? And you start building up from that, which might give you an indication where to start looking. And so we then put it together. She's climbed over, there's only a small fence on the driveway. She's climbed over the side fence, lost her shoe, because I think she's holding her face at that stage for the sheer pain. Mm. got to her wrought iron gate, and she was able then to undo the terry toweling that was holding the gate secure. And what would you do? You'd put that terry toweling on your face and hold it there. But the issue for us was we couldn't account for the fact of her being on the blind side of the house. It doesn't make sense. If you were that injured, you'd go inside the house and start assisting yourself and saying, well, what damage have I done? Or should I ring an ambulance? On the likes. So that was a big sticking block for us. So we couldn't identify anything other sinister that we have a person going around assaulting elderly women. We have got burglaries. We couldn't pry on any other crime being reported in the area because we look at everything. So that was what we were confronted with. Okay, we're not improving things here in relation to it, but we are, still treating it as a suspicious death because we may believe that an offender has put the body on the blind side of the house to secrete the person away from people and gives them time. The longer the body's not found, the better it is for an offender. And the fact of the terry toweling, the face, she's on her back, legs splayed open, skirt, no underwear, which is all sinister, sinister stuff. But you keep that open mind, and then, again, as I said earlier, about learning from every investigation you do. So the entomologist has to then go and do a temperature reading, which helps her on her calculations about the production or the development of the maggots and the insects on the deceased person. So she goes there another particular day whilst doing our investigation, and she's got to leave a thermometer there for a number of days to get a constant reading of temperature.
All right.
So as luck had it, as she's about to bury the temperature thermometer there for the number of days, she pulls out a set of house keys.
Oh.
And in pulling out those house keys, filled the reason as to why she was on the blind side of the house. She was eccentric.
Yeah.
She had no pockets in her skirt.
Oh.
She would then leave the house. She was that paranoid about someone going in there or getting the house keys. She would bury the house keys on the blind side of the house.
Yeah.
She would then lock the gate, tie the gate, climb the fence. So anyone come along couldn't break into a house, in her belief.
Mm-hmm.
But she was nicking from other people's
And she was
houses.
Nicking from other people. Yeah. But that's you don't know how these people think.
Yeah, it's just fascinating how people's minds work.
It is. But you've got to look at that because you never be surprised at what you uncover as an investigator. So that filled the last puzzle for us to say, now I can account for what she was doing there.
The poor thing was getting her keys to get inside.
Back into the house, but she just lay down there and just died with those injuries and just holding the towel on her face. So we can't be then distorted by what we find.
Yeah.
You find a woman, legs splayed, no underwear, you say, she's been raped, clearly.
Yeah.
Well, you can't say that.
Given that you couldn't prove that she hadn't, it's interesting that because of the state of the body, you couldn't prove conclusively that she hadn't been sexually assaulted. So, yes, the temptation to just assume she had must have been overwhelming.
And that's why you go where the evidence takes you.
Yeah.
Yet we had a pathologist,
and
our pathologist a world-renowned. Our pathologists are fantastic in relation to that pathologist saying, and rightly so, it's possibly an assault or it's an accident.
Yes, okay.
It's my role as an investigator to then get the evidence to support it because I'm accountable, while she didn't have any family, I'm accountable to the family of the deceased, I'm accountable to the community at large, I'm accountable to the Victoria Police, I'm accountable to myself, to my team, the whole lot of us. The accountability is there. We're not going to walk away with it because the buck stops with us.
Mm.
We need them to be able to say, we say this because of this, we say this because of that. So we went to the inquest with all that evidence in its totality. So we do have an independent adjudicator to say, well, the police is being lazy, they just don't want to make a homicide or whatever this, don't know. But we went with that totality of evidence, and because of your experience or our experience, we go to the pathologist, to the coroner, we say, based on this evidence, Your Honour, this is what we say and our experience, and because of all of that and our credibility and integrity with the justice system, the coroner said, I support what the police have brought up to me, and I put it down as misadventure and it was an accident, and away we've gone from there. And we can go away quite comfortably to know that that is the case, that there wasn't an offender out there that's made it look like an accident, even though we had no cause of death, which causes issues for us down the track because causation is a major issue for us. Nothing else turned up. Had we had a report of, we do have an unknown person in the community, in the area, doing burglaries and assaulting people, yeah. Again, we'd have to account for that. But everything, we could tick all the boxes, which we did. Everything fitted into place, even though we were lacking in supportive evidence from cause of death and any sexual assault, and the pathologist making that finding. Everything else supportively, wholeheartedly, the fact that we had an accident based on knowing about the deceased's history.
After the break, Charlie shares more about his time in the force. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Charlie gives us more insights into the inner workings of the police and the importance of the wider community in the efficacy of the police force's activities.
I can't help but think that there are places in the world where the death of an elderly woman with no family would not have, no one would have gone to such lengths. Yeah. There would not have been investigators correct. Who went as far. There would not be a coroner's court that demanded they go as far.
Mm. Correct.
Yeah.
Well, our level, our level of proof is so high here in Victoria. And I keep saying to people, the bar is so high for us to prove someone has committed a particular crime. It's not as easy. And people are better educated now of saying, well, you see a number of people in 2 or 3 in the morning in my day. Hey, Freddie, what's your name? My name's Sarah so-and-so. Today, I don't have to give you my name. I don't have to give you my address. You're going to arrest me? No. Well, on your bike. I'm leaving you. And you accept that. So now it's a matter of building a case around someone. What does the crime scene tell me? What does the post-mortem tell me as an investigator and the likes? And there's other investigations you've had where the crime scene and the body tells you it may well be a self-defence. And as we know, self-defence is a complete defence to murder, manslaughter and assaults. You've still got the right to defend yourself. This comes up quite often, more so now with these aggravated burglaries we're getting and these carjackings we're getting. Yeah. People ask me quite often when I do the presentations of saying, oh, well, what if I were able to, if I killed someone, do I end up charged with murder?
Yes.
And you say to these people, look, every person is entitled by law to defend themselves, but it's a matter of the length you go in defending yourself. It's got to be within a certain, I can't think of the word at the moment.
Parameters?
Yeah, parameters, but there's another word. So, for example, if someone is attacking you or comes and starts using fisticuffs, it's excessive self-defense if you then pull out a gun and shoot them.
Yes.
You're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, okay.
That's right. It's like the police. The police, we always say, police do not shoot to kill. Police shoot to remove the threat. And the threat's removed when the person's on the ground. So if someone breaks into your house and you start having a fight with that person dies or collapses on the ground, is incapacitated, and then you get out a baseball bat and start whacking this person while he's on the ground, you will be charged.
Yeah.
That's excessive self-defense. You cannot do it. That's proportionate. It's got to be proportionate.
It's so hard, isn't it? Because, I get that, but also the fear, the panic, if someone's in my house and my two little children are in that house and my adrenaline and I'm panicking, maybe I will kill them because panicking.
You may do that. Yeah. But I'm just saying it's got to be proportionate. Your self-defense has got to be proportionate to it. And you've got to think about 12 people.
Yeah.
We've had instances where there was a gentleman down the Mornington Peninsula where this woman was being assaulted by a burglar. He was an ex-army guy or something. He then came to her aid. He was wrestling with this offender, and he died of positional asphyxia.
Yeah.
And he lived hell for about 12 months while the police did their investigation about saying, was he justified, was he this, was he that. At the end of the day, he was saying, no, you did everything right. You were protecting this woman. You did this, you did that. The fact that he died.
Yeah.
Every little aspect will be looked at on it by investigators and forensic investigators. It's no trying to think, oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to kill this guy.
No.
I cannot think of anything more frightening than waking up in your bed, looking at a silhouette of a person at the end of your bed.
Yeah.
How frightening. And to me, I would react accordingly. You'd go out there. And you'd start, I'm not asking questions.
No.
I'm going to start hitting, doing whatever it takes to get rid of this person out of my house or if that person's on the ground.
Yeah.
And once that's done, I look at my partner, she's safe, I then look at my children.
Yep.
Okay. But it was then going to be examined if this person subsequently dies from a blow to the head or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
You are then accountable for this person's death.
Yeah.
You've then got to prove to yourself or to the community or the police that you killed in self-defence. And in doing that, okay, the adrenaline is going. I just blacked. I don't know what I did. I just kept on hitting as hard as I could until he was on the ground. But then forensically, if we're going to improve that he was on the ground through blood splatter, through our biologist, that he was in, he was hit to the head with a baseball bat and we've now got blood splatter on the wall and it goes against what you're telling us and find out you lied to that and you've gone beyond what you're entitled to do by law in defending yourself, you will be charged with the manslaughter or the murder. That's the whole thing. So you are entitled to defend yourself as long as it's in proportionate to the attack you are getting. And if you happen to have a weapon there and you do, well, so be it. You know, if you know, especially in that circumstance of a night time. But look, it's a matter of that'll all be looked at quite significantly. But
but before you move on from that, I mean, you know, there is, what do you think about that idea of having weapons in your house? I mean, to me, I have a friend who has always slept with weapons around his bed and he's never been attacked or anything. He's just this really gung-ho dude.
Yeah.
And my sort of, and again, because there's all this gang talk, I think there might be people around doing it. And my idea was always, I would think an intruder could use it against me.
Yeah, correct. I think.
Correct.
Do you think that's?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because that's always the case. It's a matter of you've introduced a weapon, the offender comes or is at a location where you are, he or she has come unarmed, you've got a pocket knife or something in your pocket or you've pulled something out, your hairspray or OC spray, whatever the case may be, to use against this person, absolutely, that can be taken and used against you because we're not really trained, you know, you're not martial arts of saying, well, we can do it. It's like, you know, when I first joined the police force, our little, what we call them, little licorice battens, we used to have little rubber battens, we used to have a strap on them because we were told you have to put the strap around your wrist because you cannot afford for that baton to be taken off you. And that's what we do. We get trained. Police get trained about a firearm being held in the position. If you're fighting with someone, whilst you're trying to fight this guy, you got to stop this person trying to get your firearm out of your holster.
Yeah.
It's firearm retention. So you're really fighting with one arm behind your back.
That's a bit hard.
And you got your OC spray because, you know, the bad guy knows that if I can get this copper's gun, it's happened in the past, the police have been shot by their own firearm. But unfortunately, they've got a myriad of handcuffs, AC spray, the baton, and the likes. So you're protecting that while you're wrestling with this guy and wanting to know. And so that's all about distance. And we're trained about keeping distance all the time because we've got the weaponry. He hasn't. Mm-hmm. We use it. We escalate, de-escalate with different things. But you're quite right in what you're saying.
Resist if the urge to take the carving knife to bed.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. But people are more, I suppose, comfortable with it by it all. Or you look at, you know, a couple of those movies like, you know, J.D. Foster, I forget the name of the movie, where it was a safe room.
Panic room.
Things like that. People now are locking their bedroom door.
Yes.
Well, that's all good and well if there's only two of you there, but what about your children?
Yeah.
So you then become you don't want to live in a fortification.
No.
With bars on your windows and the likes. You know, to me, it's a matter of we are in the world now of CCTV footage, CCTV cameras is a deterrent because how can you measure something that doesn't happen? People used to say to me when I was an ambassador for this particular security company, CCTV company, and they'd say, well, yeah, but how do you know with the value of CCTV? I said, how can you measure something that doesn't happen? Because crooks don't want to draw attention to themselves and they don't want to be identified. Regardless of the fact that they might put balaclavas on or put the baseball caps on or the hoodies, it doesn't matter. Police investigators know that might have a certain gang working in area and they'll look at gates as they walk. They might see tattoos on their hands or a watch or jewellery that will identify them.
Okay.
It's so significant. We look at the recent murder that just happened, CCTV played a major role. You look at other murders we've had, CCTV plays a major, major role in being able to do it because there's a lot of cameras. You go for a walk around your neighbourhood and just have a look around the cameras that are there.
I've had a lot of friends who've done it lately, so you think that that's a good idea?
The best thing for a community, for me, and I'm not promoting any company in regard to it, but the best thing for me, if we can get every second household with a camera on there, that is such a great deterrent in relation to it. You're not going to stop the drug craze addict. You're not going to stop that because they don't care anyway. But you are going to stop the guys casing the place. They'll be walking around the community. They'll be casing them, the professional. They'll be looking at a house. Oh, no, well, there's a car there. Oh, there's cameras there. No, we'll go to the next house. We'll go to the next house and do it that way. Sure, you push them over to your neighbour. But if you've got a sister.
I hate my neighbours, so that's fine.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking.
Yeah.
I don't.
In a previous street I lived in, there was an incident a few doors up where someone had punched a hole through the door and gone in, and it was a very strange thing. And my husband's an ex-police officer and was having a chat with this person, and this person described what had happened, and my husband's like, that's like an ex-partner who's just come in and like cut your clothes. It was very strange. But anyway, our other neighbour had really good CCTV, so we'd always go to them if something happened going, and the police did actually get an image of the person who they thought it was. Nothing happened, but it was just, yeah.
But that's where
that's how it worked.
And that's why we used to, all our interviews at Homicide were on vision. We'd always record our interviews, and that's so powerful. When a jury sees that, when you front that evidence to, they'll say, you know what, you're pretty well buggered here. You might as well plead guilty. There's photographs worth 1,000 words. How can you deny that's not you? How can you deny that's not you? You know, you look at the Bailey matter with Jill Maher.
Yes.
That footage there, let alone the, you know, and there's an investigation that was solved in front of a computer screen so significantly, you know, with the tracing of the phones, et cetera, et cetera, the footage of him going across, and that's gold in relation to it. So if we can get into a world of having every second house from a crime preventative way of supporting it, and even now we've got processes on phones that I know there's the technology is there where a lot of family violence instances that have this app on a phone where they just press this app when they're being attacked, it'll give a GPS location or record what's going on, and the police are on their way and that type of stuff. So that's where we are technically wise, because I keep saying to the groups I speak to, police cannot do it on our own. We need that community involvement and the community being part of the solution. That's why we always appeal for public assistance. Well, I think the police might know about that. I feel silly ringing the police. For goodness sake, make that phone call. If you make it anonymously to Crime Stoppers, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I know people don't want to get involved. They get in their own little group of houses and say, well, it doesn't concern me. And I used to personalise it and say, well, look, when people say to me, oh, Charlie, do I have to make a statement? Look, unfortunately, our justice system says you do. Mm. Or do I have to actually front of the accused person? Putting aside the child offences, yes, you do, because the accuser got to face his accuser. Oh, will I get police protection? No, you won't. Oh, look, I don't particularly want to make a statement. I said, no problem. I'm not going to force you to make a statement, because this, I tell them the whole process. But all I can say to you is this, if that was your daughter or your son that was assaulted, I need your evidence. But, you know, that's your decision, you know, and I don't want you to feel badly about it. But us as investigators need the support of the community so much. And I say to people, you know, don't ring your local police station.
Yeah.
I say always ring Triple A.
Yeah.
Because then it's logged and it's
logged. It's an audit trial.
Yeah.
And people get embarrassed and say, oh, but Charlie, it's not an emergency. I said, forget that. I said, do you want police attendance? Yes, I do. I said, all you're doing is cutting out the middleman or middle person. You're cutting out that middle person because you ring the police station. That's when you eventually get through. That's if they answer the phone.
That's right. Yeah.
Because phones are unring local police station. It's rung out.
Yeah.
So in doing that, the police officer picks up the phone when he's not answering the counter, not doing other things about different things or doing reports
busy
at the counter.
People.
I said they pick up the phone eventually, and when you go through the recorded message, and they say, "Okay, Mrs. Brown, yep, got that." He writes it on a piece. He or she writes it on a piece of paper, and they go back. They might get distracted. Your job stays on a desk. Police officer comes back and says, oh, that job, I better give that to D24. He picks up the phone to D24, gives them the job. So you're cutting out that middle person.
Yeah.
So in doing that, what you're saying is right. And I was discussing this. I did a talk just recently to a group of business people. And this was a licensed premises. And I said, look, interestingly enough, you know, they had a problem with either drug effect or alcohol affected patron late at night. There was no one else present. And he rang the local police station. The police never ventured up turning up because of what workload, whatever the case may be. I said, had your employee been assaulted, for example, I said, what record have you got? They would have gone, who'd you speak to? You never get the name of the police officer you ring.
Yeah.
Ever. I rang Cranbourne, and they're going to say, I spoke to the gentleman who answered the phone. Well, who was that? Don't know. But your employee, so the emphasis is back onto you as a employer, of saying, well, what did you do to protect your employee? You're in D24, and what you just said is right, Emily. It's a matter of saying there's an audit trail. I rang D24. As soon as they pick up that phone, it's been recorded. They know who is ringing that phone Or where you ring from, sir, they know it's a legitimate call.
Because then when they ring the station, they crack the shits and they say for years, and they never bloody even come.
Yeah, that's right.
They say that for years. The cops never come. Why would you ring them?
That's right. And it's true. But you say to people, unfortunately, top priority, one of the major priorities is major crime. Your family violence is one of the major priorities.
Yeah.
When you ring up as a resident and say, look, there's a car outside, I think they're doing drugs, you're low priority.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean they're not going to attend.
Yeah.
It's a matter of when.
Yeah.
It's not unusual, more so here in the western suburbs, that a divisional van, a shift, the morning shift, 7 to 3 shift, is going to hand over 10 or 15 jobs to the next shift.
Jesus.
The afternoon shift hands over 10 or 15 jobs to the night shift, and they eventually get to it. So you're asleep in bed and all of a sudden they drive past and they say, well, it's no longer there.
Yeah.
But it's all a matter of priority.
Yeah.
There's only so many police out there that it can do the job, unfortunately. Yeah. And there might be times, and I've heard people say to me, Charlie, they've just said quite blatantly and quite honestly, oh, we don't have a unit to attend.
Mm.
Frightening stuff to hear that.
Mm.
But by ringing 000, the call taker has to dispatch that job to a unit within a certain period of time, within minutes. It has to be given to a unit.
Great.
So, but in doing that, it sits with that unit until they actually go priority-wise and do the best they can.
Yeah.
And certainly don't lose sight of the fact in doing that. So don't be a bit dissuaded by that. You've certainly got information that you can ring on Crime Stoppers when there's information about an ongoing offence, no problem at all. But if you're ringing police up on a 000 call, you can say to the operator, they'll know who you can say, give them your details. You can say to them, I do not want to see police.
Okay.
Because people say, well, geez, you know, they're going to get a marked police car, a police officer is going to walk up my driveway, knock on my door. Who's going to see that? I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But you can say to the call taker, I'm reporting this, what I think is a bit of shifty, a bit of a crime going on, but I do not want to see the police. I don't want to come to my front door.
You don't even have to leave your number or name.
That's
right. You can just report it.
That's right.
And they do. We had someone in our neighbourhood who was involved in some pretty bad stuff.
Mm.
And there was a lot of shouting, violence, and there was other stuff. So I would occasionally call the police just to log it because it then bolstered the case because there was an escalating situation and I just, you know, it was logged and then that helped the police later on.
And that's the beauty of that. Like I said earlier, for that last case I just depicted, I as an investigator look at then what's been reported locally to give me indication.
Yeah.
If people aren't reporting that.
Yeah.
I don't know as an investigator to give me an idea to say, oh, in that particular case with the LD lady, we have had a spate of burglaries. We've had a spate of offences in this area. I'm start looking at, okay, I've got to start looking at something else. That gives me an indicator. Unless people are reporting it, I don't know about it because it does escalate to either family violence reports about, oh, look, I don't feel, what are the police going to do? What's the point of reporting it? The point of reporting is, okay, I've had criminal damage on my motor cars. There's been 10 cars being damaged. Look, what's the point of reporting it? What's the point? They can't do anything. You work on intelligence. Intelligence is the lifeblood of police investigations. Unless the community are reporting the crime, you then say, what's happening in your patch? You know, you've got analysts, criminal analysts saying, well, okay, we've got a pocket there. We need to bolster our patrols in that area. It is a problem area for us.
Mm.
We're getting petty crime. You don't attend to the minor crime, which leads to major crime.
Mm.
You see it in a city as an example. You see buildings, and they're not being defaced, they're not being attacked at all, but you see disused buildings with graffiti on them and the like. So, and then people look at it, it's like litter. People see a rubbish, they're going to throw rubbish
in. Yeah.
They see a broken window. That's why they call it the broken window syndrome.
Yeah.
If and same as graffiti. If they then clean up the graffiti, they might think, oh, well, no one cares. I'll just put graffiti.
Yeah.
I'll just get a rock and smash this window.
Mm-hmm.
You don't look at the, if you don't look at the minor crime, that leads to then major crime.
Yeah.
And that's where we need to be as a society. And to look at the ethos of Rudy Giuliani, what he did to New York.
Yeah.
We had the, you know, people under past chief commissioners said, well, we don't support zero tolerance and the likes. But there's certain crimes that needs to be a zero tolerance in relation to, you know, we look at.
That about violence.
Yeah, we look at it. And then you look at, there was a particular case. You look at the people in charge with family violence against women, which is so significant, and not just women.
That's right, yeah.
Then you look at the penalties being handed out. Well, what message is that then saying when courts are then saying, you know what, I was under drugs, I was alcohol, that that does not excuse you for doing what? I'm sick of hearing that.
Yeah.
I'm sick of hearing these people saying, oh, I was affected by drugs. You weren't that affected to be able to know to pick up your fist and start hitting this person or assaulting this person or robbing this person. You've made a definitive decision as an individual. Do not come with me with this cock and bull stuff that you were affected by alcohol. And some judges are saying that now. Well, I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care about that.
Yeah.
You've made a definitive decision and you're going to get the wrath of the law upon you.
Because obviously, as you say, incrementally, something has been let go to the point where you think you can get away with that.
Correct.
Drunk or whatever.
And, that's the message. What message do our courts need to send to the community? We will not tolerate.
And also
tolerate.
Families too, though, mate.
Oh,
don't you reckon?
Yeah.
Like families, you know.
Well, the whole thing is about corporal punishment and minimum punishment and the likes. And, you know, and we got to the stage where, you know, my grandkids, I go to the footy. Well, we don't score. We don't score.
Yeah.
Whistle.
Everyone gets
my under 10s, they don't score. And they're like, did we win?
Yeah. And then who gets it? Yeah. We can't give a good player award to one. You've got to give it to the all of them.
Yeah.
All stuff. And it's not a matter of winning it. So we've gone to right to the other extreme of the spectrum, and what are we creating in our society?
Yeah.
And I keep on saying, okay, it's unfortunate that the end result is with the police. It starts within the family unit.
Yeah, I agree.
It then graduates to the school environment.
Yeah.
There's no support there. Then it becomes a society problem.
Yeah.
So it lands on the police lap every time and saying, well, look, you know,
in Frankston the other day, and his mates walked down the street.
That's right.
Punched that stranger
that was shocking,
in the head.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, and then we argue the point of a person gets bail, that's neither here or there. We can discuss it now, it's before the court. But it's a matter of what messages are we sending to people out there in relation to that. You know, as you say, well, we're building these marshmallow kids up, and then they can just sit and they can say, you know what? We are better educated. I don't have to give a police officer my name and address and the likes. And I don't have to do this. I don't have to do that. They become rebellious in the family unit. They become rebellious within the school unit. Then becomes a rebellious in the in the society, in the community that we all live in.
Yeah.
All you got to say is every person is entitled to go about their business without any fear or favour or any concern. Mm. But that's not the reality that we live in. Unfortunately, you can say, well, look, you know, the police are going to get you for this or this type of stuff. They keep hearing, oh, jails are full. You know, I'll be right. You know, I've got to get caught. And the bravado these type of criminals have. And unfortunately, okay, and they say, well, when they get the message and it's slowly getting there, I can't use alcohol anymore. I can't use the drugs anymore as an excuse. Okay, mental impairment's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the Bourke Street issue that we're dealing with now and the likes. And that's absolutely understandable. We have to prove as a prosecution to say, at the time of you committing an offence, did you cognitively know in your brain that you were doing wrong? It's the same as dealing with children.
Yeah.
They've got to make that decision. So that's a different whole issue. But you then become self-induced with drugs and alcohol. You've made a distinctive decision to ingest that, knowing full well that, yeah, when I get on the grog, I go off my head.
Mm-hmm.
Well, don't drink.
Mm-hmm.
When I get on ice, I know that I'm super strong, I can do this. And I know from what I've read in the papers, the courts will be, you know, I can then say this or I can say that without a problem. When they start reading, the courts no longer take that into account. It's a consideration. You know what? I'm discarding it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting that aside is when we're going to be there. Mm-hmm. And that's really a big component of the major effect drugs are having on our community.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, and I spent 3 years in the drug squad, working undercover, buying drugs. In those days, it was heroin. We didn't have the ice issue that we had. In my day, back in the mid-80s, it was a matter. We were very concerned then of the importation of angel dust.
Yeah, right.
That's like methamphetamine, isn't it, or something
like
that? Yeah,
similar, because that
seems very 1970s, that.
Here we have now got the ice situation.
Yeah.
And I'm a big component of basically saying we keep talking about the millions and millions of dollars it's costing the community from crime, et cetera, and the deaths that are happening in our society from drugs. Yet you then look at our judicial system. Major commercial importation or trafficking of commercial quantities carries life imprisonment. So therefore, there is not one person, apart from murder, that gets life imprisonment. You look at the Mokbel situation.
Yeah.
Multi-millionaire importing drugs, commercial trafficking, I think he got 35 years or 30 years on the bottom to serve. We've got to get to a stage where major commercial importation has got to be given life imprisonment, no minimum. And basically, what commercial importation carries an average about 8-9 years.
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So if we're not cutting the head of the snake off, it's going to continue to prosper.
Yeah.
So I, as a drug importer or commercial trafficker, going to say, you know what, I'm going to bring in $10 million worth of methamphet, or I'm going to produce $10 million. Geez, if I get caught, I know the Crimes Act says life imprisonment. You know what? Average is about 10 years, 8 years. You know what? It's well worth the risk. I'm going to take that risk.
Because you could get out and kickstart it up again, couldn't you?
Correct. But it's not a matter of, I got that $10 million. That's a risk I'm going to take. I might get caught. I might. If I don't get caught, I'm doing very, very well. I get caught in Bali or somewhere over there, I'm looking at the death penalty.
Yeah, absolutely. Or
it's going to think twice. If they then start getting that message from the courts and saying, okay, I'm going to look at, whilst it says life, unfortunately, I don't know why we have maximum sentences. The only maximum sentence in our whole judiciary is murder. Mm. People get life imprisonment, no parole. Dupas,
yeah.
Life. Camilleri for the bigger schoolgirls, life. Mm-hmm. And it goes on. It becomes so inconsistent. Then you've got Julian Knight, murders 7, injures 19 or 20, gets life with 27 years on the bottom.
Paula Denyer is the one that everyone's stressed about at the moment.
Exactly. Yeah. And then ultimately,
yeah.
You know, here we have, and you've got, and whilst I've been a critic of judges in the past, judges' hands are tied. And what they, and the magic or the unfortunate word is precedent.
Mm.
Because we had two issues, which I keep bringing up. Okay, we've had Denyer. Now, Denyer pleads guilty.
Mm.
Regardless of that, the great Supreme Court judge, when he hears the guilty plea, says life imprisonment, no minimum. See you later. Remove the prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff, great strong message. And that's a straight-out appeal.
Mm-hmm.
We know that. Because precedent says if someone pleads guilty, they must be given a discount in their sentence. So we as investigators get penalised by doing such a great investigation, and they're saying, the barrister says to the defence barrister, says, you know what, you've got nowhere to move here, son. Let's plead guilty, take a discount. And you get a discount because you've got to show an incentive to other offenders that if you plead guilty and save the court time and save the witnesses giving evidence, you'll get a discount. So we get penalised, and the community gets penalised.
Yeah, because the investigators have put together such a great case.
A strong case.
That there's no point in you going to trial.
Correct.
So
let's take, plus you get a discount.
You're going to get a deal.
So Denyer goes there and the judge says, right, life imprisonment, no minimum. They appeal.
Yeah.
They said, yep, sure enough, the judge should have said that. You should have got a minimum. So he gets life imprisonment, minimum of 30 years, 10 years of life.
Mm-hmm.
He's due out nearly in 4 years.
I know. And there's a lot of concern in the community. Well, people are contacting us all the time saying, is he going to get out? Do you think he's going to get out?
Vicky Petraitis said, the family members are just going to make it their mission to not.
But what that means too is that they can't get on with their lives. It means that the family members feel as though they have to keep fighting.
Yeah, but I think there is not one politician that would allow that.
No.
And now, as they've done with Julian Knight, with Craig Minogue for the Russell Street bombing and the likes, whilst the courts are bound by what they can and can't do, it's up to the legislators then to come in.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars, and to follow us on Facebook.